Public Health Bureau of Infectious Disease, and formerly was the director of the department's HIV/AIDS Bureau. And Dr. Cranston has a unique perspective in the group as director of a state program that is already going through the throes of health reform, and he may have some lessons learned for us. So join me in welcoming Dr. Cranston.
Good morning, and thank you very much. I have to make a disclaimer. See that little IV after the MD? I have a Master of Divinity, so you can call me Mr. Cranston. That's just fine. It doesn't stop me from having an incredibly arrogant title, The Future of STD Prevention, which, of course, immediately makes me remember my favorite novel, Middlemarch, by George Eliot, and the line, "Of all forms of mistake, prophecy is the most gratuitous." In other words, who asked you anyway? Well, actually, I want to thank the CDC, ASHA, ASTDA, NCSD, and both Mary Beth and Jeff for asking me to reflect a little on Massachusetts' experience with health reform that will have, I believe, some lessons and cautionary tales that will be useful to you. I also want you to be cautious because there are many ways in which our experience may not be typical of your jurisdiction. So I will be setting a little historical context about Massachusetts health reform, talking about what we know so far about the short-term impacts of that health reform, and subsequent changes of our STD program, some of which are driven by health reform, some of which are driven by other forces, name some of the public health challenges, building on Jeff's comments. And I just want to say, you know, Jeff is such an incredible resource to us all. I hope you're taking his lessons to heart. A couple of object lessons that we can share from our limited experience, and then a few gratuitous recommendations. So in many ways, we are not a typical state in the country. We're pretty big population-wise, 14th in the nation, but we're really small geographically. That makes us very dense, third densest populated state in the country. So that changes, that's different than a lot of states are up against in terms of the distribution of healthcare systems, transportation systems, the ability to deliver high-quality STD services promptly to people who need them. We're relatively affluent. We have $50,000 per person per year per capita income, and that changes things. We have a lot of poor people. Of that 6.6 million people in our state, close to a million are immigrants and refugees. We have a lot of poor people in the state as well, but it's compensated by a rich tax base and the ability to sustain very vigorous public health programs that may not be the case in many jurisdictions. By U.S. standards, we're politically progressive. By European standards, we're kind of middle of the road. And we, unlike so many of you, have no county health system. We barely have counties to begin with. They're just lines on a map, and they're sheriffs and jails. But we really don't have a county government. We have local control in Massachusetts, like much of New England. We have 351 individual local boards of health, everything from the very vigorous Boston Public Health Commission to towns that where the health officer is the mayor, who also practically is the dog catcher. You know, it's a real variation. What we do have is the first community health center in the country, thanks to the late Senator Kennedy and his advocacy for that system. And one of the largest and most developed community health center systems in the country. 50 independent organizations with 280 sites. That is a major component of our low threshold healthcare system in Massachusetts, and enables us to have many of the positive health outcomes that we've documented over the past 40 years. We used to have an STD clinic system. It wasn't a county system like many states. It was a contracted system that relied on the CHCs, on community-based organizations, and our safety net hospitals. And as many of you know, that system was the funding for that system was eliminated in 2009, or by the middle of 2009. Relatively speaking, we have low STD incidence and case rates. Our gonorrhea rate, for example, is about one-third the national rate. And we have declining HIV incidence, about 50% down over the past 10 years. We're rich in our IT resources as well. We have a very extensively implemented electronic health record system throughout our community health centers, throughout our safety net and for-profit hospitals, and in many, many private offices. All these systems have their challenges around interoperability, but we are relying extensively on electronic records for delivery of health care. The majority of our commercial and clinical laboratories are reporting to us electronically and reporting into an integrated surveillance system that we call Maven, which is based on the Consilience software Maven package that we helped work with them over the past 6 years to develop. And we are shortly moving our STD MIS system into Maven to create interoperability across the broad range, the majority of health issues on public health and infectious disease issues that come into the Maven system. So electronic health records, case reporting, as well as our own case management from our epidemiologists are all managed in a common electronic system. So in many ways, we're not like other jurisdictions. Pardon me. So the voice doesn't turn into a total frog, I'm going to keep drinking water. But what you, I think, can learn from our experience is that our Healthy Form, in many ways, was the basis for the structure of the Affordable Care Act. And I want to thank former Governor Romney for his assistance in putting that into place. Very quickly, I don't need to review ACA with you, but just to highlight some of the similarities. You know, we expanded Medicaid considerably, both eligibility and coverage. We have an individual mandate. It hasn't been challenged in court. We have a relatively large employer, moderate to large employer mandate. They have to offer health insurance to their employees. We have an extensive Commonwealth care system that subsidizes in a proportional way the health insurance premiums for working poor individuals who are not eligible for Medicaid. And we did establish, as many of you states are in the process of doing, an exchange. We call it the Connector Board, which defines coverage, helps broker access. I love the term Expedia for healthcare. Web-based systems help people find the healthcare package that works for them and helps define the benefits, copays, and deductibles for our system. So this should all be very familiar to you as you become more familiar with the ACA. It's a single bullet, but I want to linger on it for a moment. 98% of our residents have health insurance per the 2010 Mass Insurance Survey. That means only 125,000, please, you know. It's a number we would have given our eye teeth for 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and I think Jeff is right. We've all been working for this throughout our careers. I mean, about 125,000 people in Massachusetts do not have health insurance. But since the implementation of Massachusetts Health Reform, almost 500,000 people gained health care coverage who didn't previously have it. And we're in the process of helping those individuals and the larger community transform their healthcare seeking practices so that they can take full advantage of the health insurance card that's now in their pocket. Pre-existing conditions have been, exclusions have been eliminated. People don't have to worry about getting sick later, you know, getting a cancer diagnosis and losing their coverage. They don't have to worry about spending out each year or over the course of their lifetime. And many preventive care services, all childhood immunizations, and many screenings are covered. Many of our screenings of interest, however, are not necessarily covered without copay or affected by deductible. So this is still an ongoing challenge in the STD system in Massachusetts. I don't think I need to reinforce Jeff's point about coverage doesn't equal access. I think I want to add on it and say it also doesn't necessarily mean utilization. Many people who have health insurance are still not utilizing it. We're changing generations-long habits of health-seeking behavior. And for individuals who never had a primary care physician, who always simply went to an urgent care center or an emergency department when they had a medical condition, changing those habits, changing those practices is some of our long-term work, helping folks understand that earlier treatment is better and sustained treatment is the best. So we continue to have challenges around availability of primary care appointments and long waits for some of those appointments. Emergency department use is still very high in Massachusetts, has not dropped significantly since the implementation of healthcare reform. As I mentioned, copays and deductibles are still a challenge for many individuals, particularly the working poor, utilizing their health insurance. And then there are pockets of underinsurance. This is far from an exhaustive list, but many young, healthy people who are not paying much taxes to begin with, it's a tax penalty which enforces the individual mandate, are simply choosing to take the penalty rather than buy their insurance. Recent legal immigrants who are ineligible for Medicaid under federal rules also may not be getting the full benefit of mass health reform. Many homeless individuals or the recently incarcerated, and the list goes on. You could fill in this list with from your own experience. And as Jeff has also highlighted, the goals of healthcare and the goals of public health, while overlapping, are not identical. And getting our public health goals met in a healthcare setting carries some particular challenges. So talk a little about our STD system. We, like you, like every state in the country, experienced the severe challenges of the economic downturn, and one of the first impacts was a mid-year loss of resources in our fiscal year 09 budget. Our governor is required, like all governors, to balance the budget in real time and could make unilateral budget cuts, and one of those unilateral budget cuts was to the state health department, and one of those cuts was applied to the remaining dollars, $1.2 million, in our supporting our STD clinic contracts. We started eliminating those dollars in December of 08, and by June of 09, all those dollars had gone away. While it is not caused by health reform, it's not wholly unrelated to health reform, in that a belief that expanded coverage would backfill some of these losses was one of the rationales for that decision making. We very shortly thereafter created an integrated infectious disease bureau by merging our HIV/AIDS bureau and our communicable disease bureau, and that has some real benefits for us. We have been, over the several years, with both state and CDC federal dollars, expanding our integrated testing screening sites that are screening individuals for HIV, STDs, and a range of viral hepatitides. We expanded that to a 22-site system. It's the understatement of the year. We're transforming our STD services reimbursement system. I'll say more about that and about the transformation of the roles of DIS in just a moment. Folks say to me, what happened? Did incidents go down because people are not getting screened? Did incidents go up because people are not getting treated? We have no discernible impact that we can see from our broad epidemiology. The trends in chlamydia continue to go up, as they are around the country. Our general trend down for gonorrhea saw a blip in 2010, but we've seen a 6% reduction in 2011. No clear impact tied to these policy changes. And our syphilis numbers, while relatively low compared to some jurisdictions, continue to go up. It continues to be the same epidemic seen around the country of MSM and a significant subset of HIV-positive MSM. We should not have seen an impact in epidemiology. At least 2/3 and maybe as many as 90% of STDs were already being diagnosed outside of the STD clinic system. And while that's not to minimize the role and function of STD, dedicated low-threshold STD clinic services, the epidemiology captures the big pot because all those case reports come in. So looking to epidemiology to tell the tale probably is a wild goose chase anyway. So some particular challenges for us in our STD prevention and control efforts. The impact on DIS has been tremendous. The STD clinic system created dedicated and confidential space for them to do their work, for index patients and partners to be interviewed, and for priority treatment to be guaranteed. And that space has been lost to the DIS, and they've been left to their own devices in the short term to reconstruct new ways of getting their work done. Pardon my water again. Similarly, low-threshold expedited treatment for those individuals has been lost and has been redirected to other low-threshold and, in some cases, high-threshold treatment environments. We have been relying on the family planning clinics, the community health centers, and other safety net providers to pick up this slack, and they've done a remarkable job doing so, even as they may have lost some of their patients to other high-threshold environments because of the introduction of health reform. Patient flow at primary care sites is a real challenge. our community health centers in particular are instructed under state funding to enroll people as patients so they establish a medical home and to put people through the insurance verification process. We want to get everybody on insurance, and those are both laudable goals in a primary care environment. But when a DIS is bringing a patient in who needs priority treatment for syphilis, for example, we don't want to lose that patient by going through these bureaucratic processes. And so our job is to transform and maybe create a separate pathway through some of these primary care sites for individuals needing priority treatment or preventative treatment for their STD exposure. And that's a big piece of the DIS work currently. And then we worry about, do all the clinicians, infectious disease and primary care clinicians in these sites, have sufficient diagnostic and treatment skill to follow current guidelines? And one of our jobs now becomes the assurance of treatment quality. We are, through the introduction of MAVEN, through the introduction of electronic laboratory reporting, we're getting much greater volumes of our STD data through laboratory reporting, and it often only has name, gender, maybe age, and it's lacking a great deal of important epidemiologic detail, including even anatomic site of test. The dedicated infectious disease clinics that exist in some of our sites were reliant on our specialized dollars. And it's a tough fight, and some of the folks are in the room, a tough fight to keep their dedicated infectious disease clinics, which include STD clinics, travel clinics, and other infectious disease practices, because our dedicated dollars enable them to leverage other dollars in their institutions. And so we're really worried about broader infectious disease capacity being lost in some of our healthcare institutions. An immediate challenge was the loss of ready supply of bicillin for the treatment of syphilis. It's an expensive drug that you have to buy in packs and you have to store correctly, and it gets very rarely used by most clinicians. And it was a very acute crisis for the DIS, linking the patient with the availability of bicillin. I'll say more about our proposed solution on that. And then confidentiality concerns, which have many forms. One of the primary ones that we hear is my ex, meaning my, you know, wife, my husband, my, you know, somebody else in my household is going to see that I was screened for this infectious disease because the explanation of benefits, which is legally mandated, spells out the nature of that. And so we have some recommendations in that regard as well. So some of the ways that we've tried to respond, and we're midstream, and the story is not all told in Massachusetts. We are in the process of integrating our STD surveillance into MAVEN. MAVEN is a person-based system, so missing detail that may come from a lab report may be able to be supplemented if that individual is already in the system because of some other infectious disease. So we may be able to build out what is often missing, such as race ethnicity, because an individual may have had influenza, you know, hospitalization for influenza or some other infectious disease. So there's some real advantages there and time-saving for the DIS and the epidemiologists. We have a pilot underway with one large medical practice directly transferring STD data into MAVEN from their electronic health record. And so this is a model for the future about ways in which public health can do quality assurance on primary care that takes place in private settings. It's a pilot site, but we're eager to report out on that when it's more fully developed. As we billing, you've been hearing this throughout the conference, we have moved from the payer of least resistant to the payer of last resort. And that's a transformation at the local level that actually they're more capable of doing than we imagined they would. But we have to be a partner in that transformation. And then back to DIS. They spend a lot more time on the phone and less time face-to-face with index patients and their partners. They've had to develop relationships with a much larger array of clinical providers throughout the state than they were required to do previously when they had the access to these dedicated sites. We are, again, outposting DIS, but really limiting them to very high-volume clinical sites that are very productive in terms of the numbers of STD and HIV positives they're detecting. They're playing a different kind of system navigation function, helping people find the health care they need and find it on the time frames that the standards require. And all of us are playing a broader technical consultation role with clinicians working in and through our HIV-STD Prevention Training Center and with the clinical expertise that resides at the department, brokering that technical consultation with clinicians about priority treatment and correct diagnosis, and increasingly playing a quality assurance function in that field. We have essentially solved the bicillin problem. We're utilizing our state-funded tuberculosis clinics to purchase, inventory, store, and control a supply of bicillin that the DIS will have ready access to, and gotten legal guidance that they are able to transport that without being seen as dispensers of drug. All right, so they're going to basically make sure that the drug shows up where the person shows up at the clinic they choose to be treated at, so that the individual clinician doesn't have to store it on a regular basis. We're even thinking about ways, and maybe you, and I know some of you have done this, around azithromycin, to have similar kind of ready access to azithromycin for individuals diagnosed or at risk for, or exposed to chlamydia. We have transformed 8 of those 22 integrated screening sites into treatment sites. And these, again, are CBOs and community health centers and hospitals that have special state dollars to be guarantee access to priority treatment for people with STD exposures or diagnoses. Our prevention training center is being pressed into service in a more aggressive way, and Dr. Catherine Chu, who directs our regional training center, can speak to the increased volume of demand on the training center and trying to get a wider audience to take advantage of those great federally funded services. We are trying to improve not only the data reporting from reporting clinicians, and this is, as you know, is an uphill battle, but playing a feedback role in terms of individual clinicians and the body of clinicians around treatment quality. Are they treating according to standard? And targeting what remains of our resources, our dedicated public health resources, to the most needy and the hardest to reach. We were spending a lot of our money helping very well-resourced married people hide their STD exposures from their spouses. We don't do that any longer. This is one example of the ways in which we're targeting the work. I won't go through a lot of detail on this, but in order to use our dedicated treatment resources, individuals need to meet at least one of these criteria. Lacking insurance, have other co-occurring conditions that may compromise their health care, very specific confidentiality concerns, like for young people where the EOB may go to a parent or guardian, or where there may be a safety risk, or other indications of public health urgency or symptomatic demands. So this is attempting to narrow the use of the dollars. Maybe you could say you could drive a bus through this. We're holding people to at least think through why spend the money on this individual when other folks will not get that benefit. So, to reinforce some of our lessons, safety net providers are second, are right hands in this work, and keeping them intact and preserved is part of our collective work. And we are I'm participating in a symposium this afternoon, symposium B2, to explore this question further. We have to look at those pockets of underinsurance or folks who have not been able to utilize the benefits of health reform and stay focused, particularly on the health disparities of STDs. DIS need help in transforming their roles. In the early days of our transformation, they were left to their own devices, and CDC helped us do an evaluation. It really revealed that to me in a very acute way. It's our job as managers to help DIS transform the roles and acquire those new skills. I don't say more about copays and deductibles. Patient flow, we've already talked about. Shrinking discretionary funds have to be used smarter, and they are going to shrink. I guarantee you they're going to shrink. And we in public health and we in healthcare have to cooperate across our discrete goals, and by helping to train one another in what are our priorities, I believe we can help our primary care partners do a better job addressing some of our priority goals. So here's what I recommend that you do. Work across public health issues. You know, categorical public health work will mean shrinking categorical dollars. We have to do this together across infectious disease and broader public health issues. High-tech dollars are flowing into your jurisdictions. Fight for your share of those to build your electronic surveillance systems and other capacities, and make sure your providers are maximizing meaningful use dollars. Fight for priority screening and treatment as your state's essential benefits packages. These are state-level decisions, and you have a role to play in that. You have a role to play in what your Medicaid systems will cover. You need to make the case. Plan for those loss of dollars and transform your systems to utilize what will be a new pool of resources out there in the health insurance industry. Build your capacity, your own ability to lead on the policy level, to do clinical education, and to engage in healthcare quality assurance processes. Learn about rate setting. Many of you can influence the reimbursement rates, and I want to highlight a session tomorrow in the oral session C3, in which our colleagues at Boston University, Boston Medical Center, and Mass General Hospital will talk about some of the billing challenges and some of the patient challenges that occur following the closure of the STD clinics. Rate setting is a role you can play in enhancing the reimbursability of these services. I think throughout this conference, you've been hearing about learn how to do third-party billing. You need to learn it, and your providers need to learn it. They actually maybe have more skill in it than you do. Anticipate the accountable care organization. Massachusetts is engaged in payment reform legislation right now. We have a role to play in enhancing not just the global payment for the average patient, but for the specialized payments that may come for reaching certain hard-to-reach populations or addressing certain medical conditions. You can start making your business case why prompt STI treatment is not only good for the public health, but actually may be good for the bottom line. Healthcare cost savings drives the conversation, and you need to be able to make that case locally. Work with wherever your concentrated STI and broader infectious disease diagnosis and treatment skill is, and make sure it is preserved through whatever mechanisms you have, even through combined resources with other infectious illnesses. I think we need to work about the EOBs, the explanation of benefits laws at the national level, and create carve-outs for certain stigmatized conditions so they're a little less revealing and people are more willing to use their health insurance for some of these conditions. And don't be afraid to ask people to pay for their own services if they can and they don't want to use their insurance. And again, I refer you back to the BMC presentation tomorrow. Almost 50% of individuals presenting at the BMC STI clinic were willing to pay for their own services at the $75 rate. Thank you very much. Please drop me a line.
Thank you, Mr. Cranston.
Thank you.
And I invite any of you to have, if you have questions, there are a couple microphones around the room. We have a few minutes. And I guess I'll just get us started. I did have a question. I've heard you speak before on Massachusetts, and I'm always wondering, is Massachusetts just Massachusetts, or how much can and should Massachusetts serve as a model for other states? And I guess, you know, you talk about a lot of the strategic responses that you had, you know, in terms of using the TB clinics and integrating screening and those types of things. Are those a result of particular issues in Massachusetts, or, you know, are these changes that other states really should be making? And I would ask that question to Jeff as well. You know, when you envision a better integrated public health and clinical system, you know, what do you think about Massachusetts's response, and what other different types of responses should we be thinking about, or what should we emulate from what Massachusetts has done?
I mean, many of our best ideas are stolen from others. All right, so I actually don't believe there's anything absolutely unique about Massachusetts. There's a lot we benefit from, some of the things I talked about. We have some flexibilities. We have a strong and vigorous commitment to public health. We have one of the best public health commissioners in the country in John Auerbach. So I have huge support for moving these pieces forward. But I think the core issues are universal. I actually believe ACA is such a global change in the world that it'll swallow up in Massachusetts health reform, and we're going to look very much more like everybody else come 2 years from now than we're going to look different.
I would agree with that, and I think it's, you know, Kevin's presentation was phenomenal in terms of just those last few slides giving you a checklist of things that you really need to be working through one by one by one, and, you know, we tend to say, well, you know, you've seen one health department, That really isn't true. If we really believe what we say about there being core capacities that every health department ought to have, that there is a core expectation that every individual should be able to receive certain services and certain protections no matter where they live, then we need to be seizing this opportunity in the context of health reform to really make sure we meet that vision.
Hi, Dan Wolfeiler, California Department of Health. I want to thank you both for really stellar presentations. And I couldn't help but notice that, Jeff, sort of towards the end of your talk, you began to address how we're going to use health reform to build communities that are healthier for all of us, even if they don't get clinical care. And I also couldn't help but notice that we didn't get any real strategic directions, and Kevin, you didn't address it. And I know in California we've had a real struggle trying to figure out what our role is. We've met with the chronic disease folks. We didn't get very far. We ended up having to educate them as to the fact that some of the same social determinants that they're facing also affect us. But I'm wondering where you see the dialogue going and how we move ourselves strategically closer to doing real specific work around that, whether it's health and all policies, working with Department of Justice, et cetera.
Well, I mean, it's complicated, and, you know, everyone's just beginning to date, and it's not become a serious relationship yet. But presumably we're all dating safely. But there are always risks in these new encounters. Shall I keep going? So I think everyone's sort of feeling their way in this, and so I don't think there's a particular roadmap. I think it's a conversation that has to happen within public health across, you know, when I made that comment to Jim Curran last night about, you know, maybe there should be a community prevention center and a clinical prevention center and do away with categories, I didn't mean that we weren't going to think about particular diseases, but we need to start creating structures that force these conversations. At the federal level, this National Prevention Council is forcing those conversations. And it's fascinating because when you sit with the Department of Justice, you are talking about HIV, you're talking about sexual violence, you're talking about domestic abuse, you're talking about injury prevention of all sorts, not just those that may be, you know, of interest in this room. So it becomes fascinating how when you start talking to other agencies, you have to de-silo. And we have to figure out a way to have that de-siloed conversation even within public health. And I'm not sure we know what it is yet.
Just want to add two examples. Our Substance Abuse Bureau, our Early Intervention Bureau, our Maternal Child Health Bureau, and our Infectious Disease Bureau have pooled resources to hire a former senior official in one of our large insurance industry representatives. She's now consulting to the community, and we basically want to learn how they think and learn how they receive bills and how they think about reimbursement, how they think about coding, so that we, across all those entities, we're developing our internal capacity to guide the billing processes out in the community. Another example is I'm having deep conversations with our Bureau of Healthcare Quality. They're the ones who do the surveying of everything from nursing homes to hospitals to ensure. And so we can get on their surveys, we can get on their checklists. Even if these things are not standards for licensure, they can be reportable facts, such as the proportion of healthcare employees who are immunized against influenza every year. We can't mandate that in Massachusetts, but we sure can shame people about the relative quality or relative acceptance of those practices. We can do the same around things like priority treatment for STIs.
Thanks.
Yes, Janet Arno from Indiana University and Marion County Public Health Department. Could you talk a little bit more about the security net and the underinsured, because I think they're of particular importance to us, particularly young people, immigrants, legal, and not, and what kind of arguments do you have for legislatures, what kind of estimates do you have for that kind of cost?
You know how it sells. Adolescent sexuality is politically challenging to talk about in certain circles. Undocumented immigrants are politically challenging to talk about in all political circles. And yet, these are some of the populations we have to name. The currently and formerly incarcerated fall under those lists. These are, you know, unpopular people with unpopular diseases. And unfortunately, it's our job to figure out a way to drive the public dialogue so that we can highlight the ways in which the global, the standard system cannot or may not meet many of their needs. And it is our job in public health. Data drive policy. And I think the best ways that we can do that is to highlight the ways in which the pockets of infection, the pockets of poor treatment, and the sequelae of those, and frankly the implications of that for healthcare costs and for the health of the larger population, the popular population, require us to keep dedicated dollars, require us to keep a safety net system in place. Massachusetts believes in its safety net system. That's not the hard sell for us. It's always a resource issue at a time when there are other challenges sucking the resources away. But again, it gets back to the comments we made to Dan. You know, if we're fighting just for family planning or just for the community health centers or just for dedicated infectious disease clinics and down the list, we're going to lose. Those folks have to join forces and present themselves as a common system that has many facets, meeting the needs of some complex populations.
Thank you.
Harlan Rotblatt, Los Angeles County, Department of Public Health. Where do you see the intersection in terms of the community health aspect for things that are really not individual-based but population-based, social marketing, the use of new communications technologies, condom access, things that we have to do for prevention on a larger sort of social scale? How do we fit that into the system?
It's certainly a permissible, I mean, it is, you know, the not as large as we would have liked prevention fund. It is certainly one of the permissible uses of the prevention fund. One of the things that is envisioned is social marketing around prevention. You're actually going to see a small investment around those along those lines this year. That's going to be targeted around clinical preventive services. But, you know, there certainly is, you know, that is a continuing role. And so when, you know, as you're thinking about how you're spending scarce resources, you know, the fight is to make sure that it doesn't become a one-for-one exchange, and so every dollar that you build to insurance, now you've lost discretionary dollars. But then you get to retarget those discretionary dollars and make the case for these broader population-level interventions that will guarantee, A, more effective use of those clinical dollars, third-party payer dollars, and perhaps even diminish the need for those third-party payments. You know, there's a lot of good work out there, and, you know, one of the reasons we got this prevention fund was that, on the chronic disease side at least, we were able to make the economic case. There is a return on investment. We hate doing that in public health because, you know, we're here to do good and we're going to make people healthier and, you know, don't worry me about the money. The only way we're going to hold on to these resources is by making a return on investment argument. We're at the very early stages of having the data to show that community-level, population-level interventions actually do provide a return on investment, but we're getting there. And there is an intuitive belief in that by many policymakers. We have to start making a clearer and more coherent case across the spectrum of conditions that public health deals with that there is that return on investment. That's how we'll hold on to those dollars, and that's why how we'll still have dollars for those more population-level interventions.
Here, but I was looking at the schedule. The next discussions aren't until 10:15. So if folks want to stick around for more questions, I don't know if you
sure.
all are willing. And just before people head out, if you need to, I just wanted to give a programming note that I think in some of your material that says that the ballroom levels are on the second floor. They're actually on this floor, the floor that you're on. So just wanted to clarify that for you. But I know we had another question. If you wanted to. Ask still, and if people do need to leave, just leave quietly. We can certainly get some more questions.
This will be a quick question. David Martin from LSU Medical School in New Orleans. In 2000, the HEDIS program introduced a quality issue of screening all sexually active young women between 16 and 24. Do you see that translated into the expanded programs that we're looking at? Will it still continue to be a quality measure? Or are there other quality measures that will be put in place for the new healthcare provider organizations that are coming forward?
I think the role of quality measures is going to be critical going forward, particularly to the degree that specific quality measures are associated with short and long-term healthcare cost benefits. Cost is going to drive the system. It's the only argument in the end is, can I show that I can prevent a costlier outcome down the road by providing a lower cost service now? That doesn't mean that we in public health, federally and locally, don't have a role also in advocating for good medical practice in support of public health goals. But I want to make a differentiation between those that have specific longer-term outcomes associated with them and those that are simply good to do because it's good to do. I think that the degree that we can make a business case for any one of our measures, they are more likely to be part of the mandated services that accrue to the growing universal healthcare system in the United States.
And let me add two quick thoughts. One is, think about, yes, there are these national databases and national reporting requirements. You also have the ability in managed care contracting, for example, to require all sorts of data reporting that then can become quality measures, and, what is measured will be done. So I think that's one way of getting at things at a local level where you may have particular things that you want to make sure within your Medicaid population are being assessed. But that also requires having the capacity within a health department to take advantage of all this electronic health record data and really analyze it in a meaningful way so that you know what to ask of the Medicaid managed care plans, to come to the table with an analysis of their claims data that says, you have a problem that you may not recognize and we're here to help. Because it's going to be the data that's going to convince them to make the investment in solving the problem.
Thank you.
I'm told we'll have time for one more brief question. Did you want to?
So my name is Mark Thrun from Denver Public Health. Kevin, this question is very specific to you. Thank you for a lovely presentation, because I really think you're giving us a window into where we'll all be in a couple of years. I want to follow up, and you began to answer my question just now, recognizing that the majority of STDs were previously diagnosed in private care settings. With the demise of the STD clinic, was there any intentionality to improve quality assurance in those settings, or to transfer that knowledge base from those STD clinic, the experts in those settings, into the community health centers a little bit better? And perhaps it was through quality assurance, perhaps through DIS. You've mentioned several different mechanisms, perhaps the training centers. I just wondered if there was intentionality around that.
That's a superb question. I want to be really clear about, first, the time frame of the change. The loss of those dollars was announced on day X, and in 14 days later, we had to put letters out to say, here's what, if you're going to continue doing, you can spend these dollars to the end of June, you can stretch them if you want, and some folks just literally closed the doors on the dedicated clinic. But those people are still there. They found other funding sources for the most part. Those institutions are still there because they weren't standalone clinics. They were clinics embedded in existing clinical and community-based sites. We have made efforts, and frankly, they were always the training sites. Many of them continue to be the training sites for our training center, serving the entire New England region, where the places where the best of skill for diagnosis and treatment existed was where we brought other clinicians to come in and learn, and we've continued to do that. And it really has been the vision of Dr. Hsu to really capitalize on that capacity that still remains. My concern is that over time it dissipates, that people find other jobs, that people find other roles in their institutions. And so I think the language of intentionality is apt in this case. It takes work and effort and a goal, a focus, in order to keep that capacity in there and to share it across not only the DIS, not only across infectious disease practitioners, but the real challenge is sharing it in primary care. So folks are noticing, recognizing, and knowing at least who to call for that follow-up information in that consultation. So I think it's an apt question and a good cautionary tale for everybody.
Thank you both, and thank you all for a wonderful discussion. Thank you. Thank you.